Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Take It Away, the complete solo Beatles podcast. I'm here as always with the Right Honorable Paul Kaminsky. How are you, Paul?
I'm well, Chris Mercer, who I'm sitting here now with in the material world. How are you?
I'm pretty good. We are indeed here in the material world. We have yet to get Richie, but we're working on it. Go visit our Patreon account.
That's right. Yes, in peeling back the curtain a little bit for our listeners, it's been about a year since we've recorded IRL, although at the time of this recording, the first episode of our George series just dropped yesterday, and that's so exciting for us. Thank you, everybody, for the great feedback on that first George episode, Beetle George Part 1. I know it will have been a while since you listened to that by the time you get to this episode, but hey, the feedback is wonderful.
Yeah, so from the listener's point of view, a month has passed since they heard from us last, but we did our last recording last summer. So there's actually a moment in one of these where I'm talking about enjoying a summer rosé, and that was last summer I was having that rosé. So wow, this has been a long journey.
Yeah.
It took us a long time to kind of get this up and running, as indeed it did the first time when Ryan and I started Take It Away. We were working on that for a long time before we released anything. Just kind of getting the flow of things and, you know, figuring it all out. So anyway, here we are, having figured it out, we hope, ready to dive into some really, really top-notch George Harrison today.
Yeah, and we're getting into a place with this show that I was really looking forward to getting into, i.e. albums that are starting to become outside the sphere of like classics. So up till now, George's solo career has been kind of chock full of success and classics and things people often refer to in popular culture. We took a look at his Beatles songs, obviously classics. We took a look at All Things Must Pass, maybe the most definitive solo Beatles statement, arguably, in history. We took a look at the Concert for Bangladesh, something that is still pointed to today as the really the turning point for charity rock concerts as a whole thing in our culture.
And a great artistic achievement, too.
All of those things. And at the heart of all those is George Harrison. But now we're getting to the place where the albums are really going to stop getting the level of event status that the prior albums did. This one we're going to be talking about today did still have that anticipation, that event status.
Big event.
But not at the level of what we've talked about previously. So I'm actually looking forward to that stuff because back as a listener to the original Take It Away with you and Ryan talking about McCartney, it was the outside of the norm stuff I was really looking forward to. Like somebody talking about, you know, London Town, somebody talking about Back to the Egg, somebody talking about Press to Play. And of course, the story I've told many times, which is somebody talking about Return to Pepperland. You know, that's the kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I really wanted to hear.
We love doing that. In fact, the most bored we ever were doing an episode was Band on the Run.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, we were really bored doing that. And this is interesting for me because I think I touched on this maybe on our first George episode a few episodes back, but just to go over it again quickly, I got to know George Harrison's albums in two blocks. And the first block was All Things Must Pass, Harrison 79, Somewhere in England, and Gone Troppo. That was sixth grade, about 1984. Then, you know, when Cloud Nine came out, that was an event. And then the next block was in graduate school. So we're talking mid to late 90s. And these next four albums we're going to discuss, that's when I got to know these albums. So these are albums I got to know as an adult. They're not, you know, like childhood albums for me. I find that interesting, and I was listening to them in the context of 70s pop, sophisticated 70s pop, so I was getting to know Joni Mitchell. you know, at the time, and like Marvin Gaye and 70s Marvin Gaye, 70s Stevie Wonder, stuff like that. And I was listening to these albums, these next four albums in that context, like finely wrought 70s studio pop, which all of these albums definitely are.
And that's interesting that you absorbed those in that way and were able to kind of take them as a almost like of a piece or like a sequence of, you know, three or four more or less consistent sounding, albeit different, records, I would say.
Yeah.
The mid-70s, George.
Yeah, there's a real break in style between 33 and a third and Harrison 79.
Right.
So I do think it's a little style period that we're looking at here.
So as a kid, I didn't really return to living in the material world, particularly because of its glut of, I was going to call them dirges, but that sounds really condescending. Let's call them like long, ponderous ballads or something. Slower songs. How about that?
It has this slow to mid-tempo vibe that does drag it down on your first few listens, right?
Yeah. But I may have mentioned this on the show before. I don't remember. But my dad, when I was, fifth grade, something like that, made me a tape cassette, children, called Beatles Talkin' Song, and he had plucked out from the first selection of solo Beatle albums every song that made reference to the Beatles in some way, be it derogatorily or otherwise, and put them on one cassette compilation so I could be bicycling down my lane in rural New Jersey as a elementary school lad listening to How Do You Sleep or whatever. And a couple songs from Living in the Material World made it onto that, because there are a few, more than a few, fairly oblique references to Beatles in this, and direct name drops, actually,
yes,
to Beatles in this. So Sumi Sue You Blues and Living in the Material World were two songs that I was very, very familiar with as a child because they were on that collection. And I think those stand up really, really well, just in general, not even as a part of this album, but just as two great George Harrison songs from this era.
Right. Boy, Wayne gave you one hell of an education. Really, it's amazing. So like Dear Friend was on there,
Dear
and
Friend.
Stuff like that. How Do You Sleep was on there. Yeah.
Funnily enough, Dear Friend is so long that it cut off at the end of the tape. So to this day, I listen to Dear Friend, and about halfway through Dear Friend, I'm expecting it to stop.
Maybe you'd be happier just going back to your old tape version, you know? There are things I downloaded in the Napster days that had crazy, like, MP3 artifacts in them, and I can't stand listening to any other version now. Like, I need it to just go, like, right in the middle, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm reading this McCartney Legacy book and just enjoying the absolute hell out of it. Anyone who hasn't picked up this McCartney Legacy book definitely should. But in that book, talking about Dear Friend, it gave me a new appreciation for that song, actually. And I listened to it with new ears after reading the thorough context there. But anyway, we're not here to talk about Dear Friend today. We are here to talk about George Harrison's 1973 album, Living in the Material World. And like we always do, we're going to go through a bit of background, and then we're going to talk about the songs, and we're going to kind of do all the catch-all stuff that came in and out of this period. But this album is kind of, I wouldn't say unique exactly, but it is an album that really left it all on the court, in that there's not really all that many B-sides or outtakes or songs that didn't make the cut to speak of.
Yeah.
This was an album that George really wrote more or less whole cloth,
right,
for the purpose of this record. And so I love albums like that don't actually pick up bits from the past, because they're much more of a snapshot of the now.
Yeah, it's interesting. You have these artists, like a few come to mind, Steely Dan, Paul Simon, Billy Joel, where you just don't have leftovers. Maybe you have a B-side or like one track that's kind of unfinished. But yeah, it's interesting. It's the opposite of the scattershot McCartney method of just write a bunch of stuff and let's see what gets on there. It's more like, you know, let's put an album together with a pair of tweezers, you know?
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that, because you could look at the gap between 1970s All Things Must Pass and 1973's Living in the Material World as kind of a long break by solo Beatles standards, particularly in this era. And, you know, that's also supposing that you subscribe to that as the standard by which we should all hold ourselves to, because nowadays an artist will take a few years break, and that actually seems perfectly normal and fine. But back then, McCartney was putting out two albums a year.
Yeah, and singles.
And singles. But let's talk a little bit about that, because actually the break is not as long as it appears. Because
it's not. This,
yeah, All Things Must Pass came out late November 1970. So let's say people got it around Christmas, right?
Yeah.
I was, one of my last functions before I left LA, I was at a rooftop party in Santa Monica, and the person had on a Casey Kasem, whatever his show was called, Countdown with Casey Kasem, whatever it was called. And it was from a specific broadcast, and I heard My Sweet Lord on there. And so when he came up and he's like, I bet y'all can't guess what year I plucked this from. And I went, that's 1971. And he went, what? How did you know that? Because My Sweet Lord would have been the biggest right around 1971. Cause that's, you know, right when the single kind of comes out later in the year, people got it for Christmas. Like, this album, it was released in 70, but really took a long time for people to absorb well into 1971.
I've always sort of thought of it as a 1971 album for that reason. Because that's when the singles were out. That's when it was kind of, you know, in the air.
Right. So then you have that. And then in August, in the summer, Bangladesh, the concert for Bangladesh, which we've talked about last episode. And that album came out December 71 with its film debuting in March of 72, and then it won the Grammy for Album of the Year in March 73. So there's Bangladesh stuff happening all throughout the remainder of 71 and really throughout 72. And a lot of the turmoil you hear on this record, which I can't go into huge detail about simply because the specifics are so tangled and beyond me, but really, one of the largest points of occupation for George at this time was unraveling the tangled, awful, frustrating web that was the funds raised by the concert and the film and the record for the people of Bangladesh. And it's this whole mess involving capital, and George had a beef with the capital head, and there's this stuff with UNICEF, and he had to set up a separate fund, and then Alan Klein was kind of dipping his hand in the cookie jar, and it's this whole big headache. So he's doing that, and that's really sapping up a lot of time. But when you think about actual output, that's two Christmas seasons in a row with big George Harrison releases. You have a triple album in the Christmas of 70, you have the double album in 71, and then you have a feature film that follows. And then George is also doing stuff with Ravi Shankar at this time. There's another film he's working on and LP called Raga, which I think we've talked about on the show prior.
Yes.
But Raga shows Ravi Shankar's kind of journey throughout. It's almost like Ravi Shankar anthology or something like that. But George is in it a bunch just because, well, not a bunch, but he's in it a little bit because George kind of encapsulates that Ravi wafting into Western music kind of thing. And so George is also doing that. So when you see him on like the Dick Cavett show, for example, he's promoting Raga, but of course all they want to talk about is Beatles. But yeah, so he's a busy boy. He's a busy boy at this time. Talking about the path toward the actual recording of this album, I tried to sum it up in a couple different bullet points, but the first one that I kind of keyed in on as one of the major driving forces behind the record was this idea that George had a new circle of friends. As demonstrated in the Get Back documentary, the Beatles were an incredibly insulated organization with only a precious few sort of cracking that inner circle, as they called it. It's part of the reason why Yoko Ono was looked at so askance by George and others, because Yoko really, not only did she make it into that inner circle, she lived and breathed that inner circle for a while. And obviously that was because she was, you know, the girlfriend and then married to John Lennon, kind of an esteemed inner circle position, but she made her presence felt within that position really noticeably. And so you have this very tight-knit situation, dynamics of people, and then when they break up, they're sort of scattered to the wind. You see this with McCartney. I think George was even quoted one time as saying, I don't think he has a lot of friends. Because, you know, yeah. George, the first thing he does, he goes on tour with Delaney and Bonnie, and he'd already been building relationships with Dylan and the band and stuff. So he's building a friend circle outside of the Beatles. It's not that McCartney didn't, but McCartney's friend circle tended to be safer choices. He's just kind of a safer guy in general. Yeah. So who are his friends? Yeah. Peter Asher, his girlfriend's brother, you know, like... And then people Peter Asher introduced him to. So you get that kind of sort of maybe safer net. But George was really, you know, he kind of cast a wide net. And then he met a few key people. And those key people show up on All Things Must Pass. But the bigger ones that show up on this record are really Nicky Hopkins and Gary Wright.
Right.
So Nicky Hopkins, who is this incredible virtuoso piano player, who played on some Beatle stuff too, uncredited, which... still blows my mind to this day. Nicky and George really struck up a really powerful friendship at this time. Nicky was in between Stones records. Again, more or less, I wouldn't say uncredited, but Nicky's sound really helped define a lot of those Stones records in the late 60s and early 70s. And the fact that he wasn't kind of, I don't know, recognized for it in sort of in a bigger way is really kind of disrespectful and weird to me. But Nicky and George were kind of palling around a lot at this time, and Nicky's LP, The Tin Man Was a Dreamer, was recorded at the same time by more or less the same people as Living in the Material World. So
I gave that a listen today.
You did?
I had never heard it.
And what'd you think?
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's a really excellent album. And looking at the credits, yeah, a lot of familiar names here. We're seeing Klaus Voormann, Ray Cooper, Jim Horn, Bobby Keys, Jim Price, familiar folks. And a fine album.
Well, Chris, would you be okay if we played a little bit of that?
I think we should play a little bit of that. Yeah, I bet a lot of people haven't heard it. So very cool.
Yeah, Nicky Hopkins doing it out there. Like, he's one of a few of these studio musicians that release solo records at this time. Like, I think Bobby Keys put one out too. Then that's great. I'm happy they were able to kind of get out there and at least try to break out of the dynamics of these sort of larger conglomerates they were linked to.
We've mentioned Nicky Hopkins. We haven't really talked much about his output or his performing, you know, studio performing, but I'm looking at the list here. Like you said, Rolling Stones and major Rolling Stones, you know, there's Satanic Majesty's Request and Exile on Main Street and Jeff Beck, Joe Cocker, I'm just doing the big ones here. Jefferson Airplane, he played on Imagine and Walls and Bridges. He played on Ringo and Goodnight Vienna, the two best Ringo albums to me. He played on The Who, My Generation, and The Who by Numbers, Carly Simon, No Secrets, Son of Schmilson, just the list goes on and on and on, but really interesting. And of course, Flowers in the Dirt, which is where we've encountered him on this show before.
Wow, I think I forgot that.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, this is a much longer list than I'm getting into, but wow, dude got around.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, if Nicky Hopkins never quite got his due as a solo artist in the way that I think he was definitely worth, Gary Wright is one that kind of lived a similar path, but then definitely got his due. Of course, Gary Wright's story is a little bit different because before being this big, successful solo artist in and of himself, he was also out there with his band Spooky Tooth. playing on All Things Must Pass and palling around with George in that time as well. So Gary Wright was so tight with George at this time, he actually traveled with George to India in 72 and made a comment, I think it's noted in Simon Lang's book, about how passionate George was becoming about the Krishna movement at that time, even more so than earlier in the decade. George was looking to really buoy himself with something that he felt was steady and good and righteous and pure and all of that. And so he really thrust himself harder than he ever had at this time into Indian culture and into Hare Krishna and all of that. Gary Wright was sort of along for the ride, but didn't take it as far as George did, certainly. I saw Gary Wright live a couple times with Ringo. Oh, wow. And yeah, he's great. He's great. People know him mainly for Dreamweaver, I think, is the big one.
Of course.
It's one of those songs that I think I heard for the first time with the All-Star Band, actually, and was like, oh, really? Neat, like Frankenstein. I also heard for the first time with the All-Star Band. And I remember thinking, like, wow, this is really good. And then the moment that it occurred to me that this was a bigger song than just weird Beatle people was Jon Stewart played it on The Daily Show. And I was like, oh, neat. There's yeah. Gary Wright.
That's one of those ghost from childhood songs for me, you know. It's like,
Chris, would you please indulge me and just play a little bit of Dreamweaver here?
I will, yeah.
Thank you. I think there is a story that links George to that song, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. I can't swear by that, but I'm fairly certain that that had some connection to George. And then one friend, noticeably, is absent from this record and from George in the way he had been at this time, which was a strung-out-on-heroin Eric Clapton. Now, Eric was involved in the next bullet point here, but not the sole cause of, I want to make clear. The next bullet point after this new friend circle I have written down here is a crumbling marriage. So George's marriage to Patty Boyd at this time was falling apart. Now, I felt weird about even typing this because this show is not about that, you know, and it's not about gossip and it's not about who wrote what in somebody's book.
And I appreciate you saying that, and we are going to get into it briefly. And I appreciate you saying that, though, because, you know, you're reading this McCartney Legacy book, and that seems to be a musical biography, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the Simon Lang is a musical biography, and the Luca Parassi is not even a biography. It's about music. There are so few books like that. Most of the books are gossip. It's who was sleeping with who, what drugs.
Sure.
It's frustrating that there are so few good books on the actual music. And that's why we end up coming back over and over to the Simon Lang, or like we did with the Luca Parassi, because that's it.
Yeah. The reason why I felt like this was worth including, at least in an abbreviated way, was because it actually changed my whole perception about what this record meant to George. So
it is important.
Yes. I would argue that you can't really talk about Plastic Ono Band without talking about the breakup of the Beatles and Primal Scream. Right?
I wouldn't suggest that you could. I just wish that more people would actually dig into the songs. You
know? Sure. But I guess in terms of background, like those are right. Those are catalysts, let's call it, for the songwriting. I think that is fair to say.
Yeah.
And when I listen to this record at face value, what I get is a lot of God. And what I feel like is a lot of preaching, which is what I think a lot of critics got too. But when you really take a harder look at the album and knowing where George was in his life, this album is much more like Plastic Ono Band than any Krishna-related album or something like that, which I think is not a an observation unique to me. I think Simon Lang even made it as well. But this record is about somebody's life is actually kind of coming down around them, and he finds himself at a crossroads. We think of Dark Horse as the album where, oh man, everything went nuts because George kind of said it. He said as much. But at this point in George's life, he could go left or he could go right. You know, maybe left is the more spiritual path, the more pure path, the one he wanted to lead, and right is into drugs and general sort of mayhem in terms of, you know, flings and sex and the material world. I mean, that's kind of, it's in the title. It's in the title. So I want to touch on this because of that. So after All Things Must Pass, Eric Clapton's feelings for George's wife, Patty Boyd, started to boil over. And soon George found out that the two had been kind of meeting in secret. There's also, of course, at the time, Eric had written the song Layla about Patty, which was cut shortly after All Things Must Pass with the band that formed during the All Things Must Pass sessions. And just a brief excerpt from Patty's book, she was saying that they were meeting secretly in a flat in South Kensington. And there was a moment, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but where George found out basically and said, well, who are you going to go with? And at that time, she went with George, but soon thereafter, she wound up leaving. And there was other kind of affairs and stuff too. There was this thing with Ronnie Wood, which again, we don't have to get into too much. Although I would point out, I was at a Beatle Fest where Patty Boyd was talking. It was her first one. She's been at a few fests since then, but it was right when Wonderful Tonight came out from her book. And who shows up at Beatle Fest in the back unannounced but Ronnie Wood, who's there looking out. And I saw him. I was standing right next to him looking with these loving, gazing eyes at Patty. And I just remember thinking, I'm living in history. This is amazing, you know, because they had this sort of tryst too at the time. But
yeah.
George was also meeting with Ringo's wife, Maureen, behind Ringo's back and in front of Ringo's back. He proclaimed his love to Maureen over this dinner in front of Ringo. It was really weird. But anyway,
I didn't know any of that stuff, by the way, till I reviewed for this episode.
Yeah.
About Maureen. That is some sordid shit.
Lennon called it the next closest thing to incest because it's a Beatle wife. You don't do that.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not saying any of this to sort of like wag my finger at George or anything. I'm saying this to say, look, his life was in some disarray here. Just his personal life at home. You know, coming home to a house like that must have been really hard.
Yeah.
And what do you do in those instances? You turn to substances to help, right? To help cope. And George, unfortunately, was doing a lot of that at this time. And I don't judge. I say some of this out of experience, you know. It's hard to deal with that stuff. And George, to his credit, at this time was still trying to say, well, maybe spiritualism can also save me. But I think he was forever being tugged to that material world. And this is the soup that cooks living in the material world. It is George looking at his paths and trying to make the right choice, but being forever tempted by the wrong choice.
Yeah. And, you know, we've touched on it before, but this is why rock stars do drugs. I mean, there's an enormous amount of pressure involved. Imagine having a personal life that is public. Be enough to make you want to snort a bunch of cocaine.
Of course, yeah. Yes, because that at least makes sense. That has a cause and effect. It's a simple thing that can change your state so you don't have to really think about it. And it has a beginning and an end to it. Whereas these other quagmires are much... The other big one here is the John, George, and Ringo were leaving Alan Klein at this time.
Yeah.
And acknowledging, he said kind of frustratingly, that Paul was right.
Yep.
From the start.
Seems like Paul was on to something with this Alan Klein character. Yeah. How about that?
There's an excerpt from Peter Doggett's book, and Doggett has a, let's call it hit or miss reputation in Beatle world for reading into things, but he does quote a Jeff Emmerich passage, which recalls Harrison wearing a Hindu prayer bag and mumbling away, chanting his mantra, often unable to reply to questions put to him because he was just so overwhelmed and frustrated by the material world.
Mm.
It's a lot. That's a lot to take in. Music must have also been a nice therapy for that. So let's talk a little bit about the recording of Living in the Material World. another bookend right now is this is the final bow for Apple Studio. So in October 1972, recording commenced on the sessions that would yield Living in the Material World, and the sessions would continue through overdubbing sessions as late as March of 73. Backing tracks needed to be wrapped by December so Nicky Hopkins could go play with the Stones in Jamaica and make goat's head soup, which is really funny to me. It was almost like Ringo having that heart out for Magic Christian during Get Back. Nicky Hopkins is like, hold on, I got to make Mick Jagger sound good for a minute. But the bulk of the album was put to tape at Apple Studios, London, the same studio that the Beatles broke in January 1969 during Get Back, and whose grand opening didn't arrive until 1971, well after the Mop Tops had called it quits. This was, in fact, the last George Harrison project to take place in Apple Studio, a symbolic nail in the coffin of the optimism and promise of Apple, as George seemed the most gung-ho about its opening in 1971. Klaus Voormann, who was on hand for all of these sessions and really any Beatles solo project in the early 70s except Paul McCartney's, contends that the bulk of the recording was actually done at George's house at Friar Park, which it sounds like there's evidence that that is actually true. Like, there is a bunch of stuff that was put down at Friar Park, but I think it was, you know, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. It was probably a split between Friar Park and Apple Studio. Apple Studios are beautiful studios. A lot of people recorded there. Ringo, after the Alan Klein years, wound up working there with Paul on 6 o'clock, or maybe it was just Step Lightly. I forget which one it was, but it was like overdubs on the Ringo album there. It seemed like a great space, great studio.
Yeah.
That leads to the second sort of bullet point general thing that I want to talk about as it pertains to the recording of Living in the Material World. So George, for this album, rather than the spectery kind of thousands of musicians approach, wanted a more of a band dynamic with this album. So he had a tight-knit group of players who he played with like a band, and then there were sort of guest stars amongst them.
Now, I wanted to say something about that. First of all, I think people take the terminology wall of sound and they make it a bigger thing than it is. It's not really a wall of sound. It's really just a lot of doubling and tripling. So All Things Must Pass may have 4 acoustic guitars, but they're all playing the same thing. It's just a way to get a chorusy sound, like a non-mechanical way to get a chorusy sound. Same with like Imagine, that's just John overdubbing the same piano part, so it kind of has a bigness, but it's just one part. So I think the wall of sound thing is, I don't know, I think people play it up too much. It has a bigness in the orchestral sense that you have a bunch of violins playing the same melody, but not in the sense that it's larded with like busyness. It's not like a really busy arrangement. So I mention that because I don't think this album sounds that much scaled down from All Things Must Pass. I hear a bunch of horns and strings, and the band we have here is, you know, sometimes a 5-piece band, and they're a big sounding band. So it's not exactly like the stripped down answer to All Things Must Pass. Maybe you disagree, but this album has like real grandeur to it to me.
Yeah, when I was going through the track by track, I actually found myself enjoying it sonically a lot more than All Things Must Pass because I could hear the different instruments playing different things. It felt a little more real to me. And I think that may just be a taste thing.
Okay. You know?
I think what you said is interesting just now about there was only a couple people playing in the band, you know, for some of the songs. And then there was like double and triple parts and stuff. And it was more like an overdub thing. It was more of like a piece of studio work, right? It was like a production choice. And that falls in line with one of the quotes we heard from George at the time, which was like, hey, I'd be down with the guys on the studio floor and we'd be really grooving. And then I'd get up to the control room and I'd be like, what the hell is this? It would just sound different because of the way Phil was approaching the recording, where he was placing the mics, how he was doing. So I think maybe, and again, I don't want to keep pointing a finger at All Things Must Pass production as a problem, because I know you like it. And it's the bloody Beatles White Album. Shut up. Right. It's the bloody, All Things Must Pass.
Yeah.
Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
I think personally, I prefer something that sounds a little less
processed, maybe.
Sure. A little more real, yeah. I guess. I don't know.
But I'm just saying Living in the Material World does sound big.
Sure. I guess he was trying to keep it more of the, like, the same people. And more often than not, that is still true. It's like one band, not unlike what McCartney was doing with Wings, really, which was that he wanted to be in a band. He wanted to play in a band.
Yeah.
Now, when push came to shove, there was no mistaking that that was Paul McCartney's band.
Right.
So you could make an argument that George was maybe being a little more honest with how he was approaching the band, where it's like, okay, it's a George Harrison album, even though he wanted a band playing on it. But I think the personal rapport between those specific musicians is what I'm talking about here. So those musicians...
That makes sense.
So those musicians are George, obviously, Klaus Voormann, Beatle friend for decades at this point, which we've talked about on the show many times. Jim Keltner, again, talked about many times. Gary Wright and Nicky Hopkins, who I just mentioned. So there's a handful of other revolving additions and subtractions, but the George, Klaus, Jim, Nicky, Gary combo was the core. George also self-produced this record. So I couldn't find a lot about why George made the decision to produce himself.
Did.
Oh, you did? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, great, great, great.
Yeah, so it's from an interview that George did in 1987. It's November 87, Musician Magazine with Timothy White. And this is what George said. Phil worked on the second solo album. By that, I mean he was around. Again, he kept falling over and breaking his ankles and wrists. The guy who was his helper was having heart attacks. Phil was never there. I literally used to have to go and break into the hotel to get him. I'd go along the roof at the Inn on the Park in London and climb in his window yelling, "Come on, we're supposed to be making a record." He'd say, "Oh, okay." And then he used to have 18 cherry brandies before he could get himself down to the studio. I got so tired of that because I needed somebody to help. I was ending up with more work than if I'd just been doing it on my own.
Oh, Phil.
So there's your confirmation that Phil was a freaking problem. Phil was a huge problem. I mean, we're getting into Ronnie Spector a little bit later on, and I didn't know the depth of the abuse that he subjected her to. But God, Phil was a problem. I might defend his production. I'm not defending him as a person.
God, that sucks. Yeah, the thing too is like his alcoholism was a new feature at that time, according to the sources I've heard and things like that and read. That only started to happen right around when Phil got involved with the Beatles. Like, that wasn't the early Phil. And I guess you could almost like say, well, that stuff, maybe it's lurking in the background of your life and then really takes off. But like that, the advent of that was a very much a new thing. I mean, John Lennon had to take out an ad in like the newspaper to call, to try and let Phil know he was ready to record Plastic Ono Band. He took out a whole page ad that just said, "We're ready, Phil," or whatever. It was like that.
He didn't do what he needed to do, which is climb into the window at the hotel. Jesus.
But George, you know, had his own production pedigree. He had been producing stuff since at least 67, 68, more 68. And, you know, the notion that he was working with this close-knit band that were, who were all world-class musicians and stuff, and he had this own, you know, he had his own production style. He had picked up stuff, obviously, from George Martin, obviously from Phil Spector. A lot of the Motown sound you hear on this record is kind of credited to George kind of getting through osmosis that Phil Spector approach to things. And not, I mean, Phil, George was also a fan of that music, but I mean in the sense of like capturing it on tape. George had the tools at his disposal, and I think George did a fine job on the production on this record, if not just as good, in my opinion, or better than the production on All Things Must Pass. They're different animals, but I prefer this production style more. And as I mentioned earlier, this was more or less all new material. Every song on Living in the Material World was written after 1970. There is one exception, sort of, with Try Some, Buy Some, and we'll talk again about the Ronnie Spector of it all a bit more when we get to that point. But look, that's a huge feat. You know, there's no digging through the scrap bin from All Things Must Pass. There's no sifting through old Beatle papers. No, this record was a snapshot of the moment. And I don't personally have a problem with going through and finding, you know, the older material that wasn't ready at the time and then became ready. Like that, none of that seems like cheating or something to me. But there is something kind of like interesting and unique about, wow, this is all new material. Really cool.
It's really cool, and it's a bit of a flex when you consider that he had all that stuff left over from All Things Must Pass, and he didn't dig into that.
Right.
And some of those songs are good, you know.
Yeah.
Impressive.
Yeah, so the album was released May 30th, 1973 in the US, and almost a month later in June of 1973 in the UK. And it was, of course, released on Apple Records, produced by George Harrison, with one track credited as a co-production with Phil Spector, which was Try Some, Buy Some. The basic tracks, as I mentioned, were recorded by George on guitar, vocals, and all writing credits. Klaus Voormann on bass, Jim Gordon, Jim Keltner, and Ringo Starr on drums. A flute and saxophone by Jim Horn, Gary Wright on keyboards, Nicky Hopkins also on keyboards, and somebody named Zakir Hussain on tabla. And we'll get more into who Zakir is and why that's interesting later when we get to the track by track. String arrangements were once again conducted by John Barham, George's longtime friend and collaborator on the strings for both All Things Must Pass, as well as, we learned, the Phil Spector Let It Be overdubs. And John Barham was also a noted Indian music enthusiast and also joined George on that sort of trip. I put a little section here for inside jokes because there's some that I find very, very funny. Maybe the funniest, I'll go ahead and spoiler alert, at the bottom of the back cover is a takeoff on the Wings Fun Club, which obviously Paul McCartney had just started up and started putting on the backs of his record. And George, in his infinite mockery, put that you had to send a self-addressed stamped...
It's a stamped undressed elephant.
A stamped undressed elephant to join the Jim Keltner fan club.
And I'm looking at it right now, and I can confirm that the wings around Jim Keltner are on both the original LP and the 2006 CD as it as well.
Oh, yeah. I had the record in front of me. Why did I not read that? Yeah, Jim Keltner fan club for all information. It's just, what a... The fact that he's still taking swipes at McCartney so far removed from all this stuff is really, it's funny.
The joke's on George because Wings is about to become one of the biggest bands in the world. So, you know.
Yeah. Photographer Ken Marcus shot a mock Last Supper image used on the inside cover, which features George and his band, with lawyer Abe Summer standing in for Gary Wright, who wasn't present for the photo. He just put the lawyer in there. and it often goes unnoticed, but the album's title does not appear anywhere on the front or back cover, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it went unnoticed by me until you pointed it out. It's true.
Yeah. It's on the spine, but who can read that?
Yeah.
Certainly not I.
I'm sure there was a sticker.
But. Yeah. Just like they did on Wings Wildlife, because I think Paul did the same, except on the front. It was on the back cover. But.
And I think it's really classy to have just a cover with no writing on it. That's pretty ballsy to me. Even if the record label is going to slap a sticker on it, I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, Simon Lang uses the word confident a lot in his assessment of this record, and that kind of a move does imply confidence. And you know what? In George's defense, or maybe he doesn't need defending, but from George's point of view, let's say, he had every reason to be confident at this time. He just had these two huge smashes, you know, to his name. All Things Must Pass, Concert for Bangladesh. Like, he proved his point, as Derek Taylor said. Anyway, the last little bit of curiosity here is that the record has Hare Krishna etched into the Matrix trail off on one side of the record, and Hare Rama.
Yeah, I double-checked it. It's there in the dead wax.
So here's something cool. So here's something I didn't know that I only found out when I was doing the research here. So the cover photo was taken by this photographer named Kendall L. Johnson, and so my first instinct was to then look up who Kendall L. Johnson was, and I was like, why did this guy like never do anything else for anyone else? It just sort of seemed strange to me. So then I looked it up, and so it shows George's hand through something called electography. Art director Tom Wilkes had taken George to UCLA where electography was being studied. And this is via a site I found called Material World Pressings. The images themselves are the product of the process known variously as electography or electrophotography, or as Curlian photography. When electricity is passed through an object, it is possible to photograph the electrical field known as a corona discharge. So the image on the front, the scanned image, shows George's hand in which a silver pendant of Baba Ramdev, Ramdev Pir, on horseback. Ramdev was a ruler in the Indian state of Rajasthan in the late 14th or early 15th century, being the son of King Ajmal Tanwar, the ruler of the city-state of Pokharan. According to legend, Ramdev was actually an incarnation of Vishnu. So that's what that is. So that is what George is holding on the front. And then on the back, the scanned image of George's hand holds three contemporary coins from the United States of America. Two of these are quarters, and the other is an Eisenhower dollar. Unlike the pendant on the front cover, the dollar and the quarter coins were likely clad from copper and nickel instead of silver. So there it is. There's the dichotomy.
Yeah.
You have the divine, and then you have the material world.
Yeah, it's an amazing package design, really, with the gatefold. The front and back cover are beautiful. They look really great. Even the inner sleeve is like really nice paper. It's like made of really thick, nice paper that this old copy has yet to break.
The literature I found says that it's the same kind of paper that you're referencing there as was in the Concert for Bangladesh packaging. So,
oh, no kidding.
George was going for a higher end kind of feel to this.
Yeah.
Because, again, it was it's still considered an event. This George Harrison, his follow-up to All Things Must Pass, that's a big deal. He was going for something prestige-looking. Now, this is something that I just point out because I find it a little sad, but also kind of expected. But Paul, when he did Wildlife with Wings, made a point not to include the apple on the label, on the records themselves. He has an image of himself on one side and Linda on the other. Apparently, this was controversial at Apple at the time because it was sort of this, I don't know if it was unspoken or not, but the idea was that all the records, despite what they were, had an apple on there. Paul's thinking was, well, I'm boycotting Apple. I hate Alan Klein. I will not do anything you say. And Paul was being very obstinate in trying to distance himself from that. So Paul like kind of popped the cherry with that. And then talked about it in one of the musical papers. And of course, Lennon, whenever anyone says somebody did something first before John, John, of course, wrote back and he's like, that was my idea. You stole it. I wanted to do it for this and that. So anyway, by this point, especially as we're rounding out the Alan Klein years, none of the Beatles really were using the Apple logo anymore. In fact, when the Ringo album comes out, no, it's not the Apple on there. It's Ringo, you know, in a big star doing his thing.
Well, and it's interesting that that arose from animosity because I love those custom labels.
Yes.
They're so cool.
I do too. And so anyway, this one, again, does not have the Apple logo. It's sort of unclear whether this is George kind of following that lead or George simply saying, fuck it, or having a better idea. But instead of the Apple logo, there are these paintings, these beautiful paintings of Krishna and Arjuna in Arjuna's chariot from a 1972 edition of the Bhagavad Gita As It Is. And that is the background and release of this record, and it was a lot, but I think I'm about ready for the track by track.
Okay, so let's do the old track by track.
Track one, Give Me Love, parentheses, Give Me Peace on Earth.
Give me love, give me love, give me peace on earth. Give me light, give me life, keep me free from birth. Give me hope, help me cope with this heavy load. Trying to touch and reach you with heart and soul.
Yeah, so this one, kind of a chant, I guess, which is a good way to let yourself off the hook for not really finishing the lyrics.
Oh, wow, coming in hot.
I figured that would be something as a chant, my carnival. It's a mantra, man.
Yeah.
This is a wonderful, wonderful record. I'm not knocking it.
In that Scorsese documentary, and forgive me if I've brought this up before, but there was some quote from either Olivia or whoever it was saying that George used to just drive around Europe and England just chanting for hours and sometimes days at a time. So it does not surprise me at all that there is a lot of chanty stuff happening here.
Yeah, sure. And I think of it a little bit like an instrumental track that has the bonus of lyrics, right? You know, I mean, we got that instrumental track at the beginning of Dark Horse that we'll come back to. It's a bit like that. Or even You, which is not a very lyric intensive song, but still has a lot of energy and has a great place on the record, on the album.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this is stronger than You. do you think that this and You are like on par?
No. I'm not suggesting that at all.
Okay, good. Okay.
I'm just saying they're similar in the sense that the lyrics are minimal and kind of not really the point, you know?
Yeah. And I think this one, I don't know, this one feels very in line to me with the previous record. I think my first note on it is literally that it just seems to echo for me My Sweet Lord in spots, either consciously or subconsciously. But I think it's ultimately maybe not as successful because it doesn't have quite as much going on. But I do think it's worthy of the success that it was. So this was a single, and it did pretty damn well.
Yes.
I pulled some chart data here. It hit number one in the Billboard Hot 100, number one U.S. Cashbox, number one in the U.S. Record World Singles Charts, and then it was top 10 elsewhere in the world. But America could not get enough of Give Me Love, yeah. Give Me Peace on Earth.
It's a pretty sweet vibe, you know? It really is. It's a great sounding record with the piano and the acoustic guitar. Of course, the amazing slide guitar stuff, which is, I think, really the main focus of the record is showing off the slide guitar work. You got to love that call and response at the very beginning. Very nice.
Yeah, it's a graduation of his guitar playing, I think, in a lot of ways. It feels like he took everything he learned from creating and crafting that slide playing on All Things Must Pass, and now he's using it. You know, it's like he made the sword, now he's heading into battle, you know, kind of thing. I remember Paul McCartney was quoted at the time saying that he loved it and that he found, I remember this, I don't know why this sticks out in my memory so clearly, but I remember him calling the guitar solo ace, which to this day, I would love to make work as a slang again for I really liked it. Hey, that was ace, man. And
yeah. We're bringing it back. You and I will bring it back.
We'll bring it back. But what's nice about that, though, is that this is still in the midst of their bitching and bickering. And I do love that McCartney went out of his way to like compliment George's songs, because George doesn't really reciprocate in the same ways. I think he had a couple nice things to say about the McCartney album. But as we've talked about, this album has a lot of subtle digs at Paul, which are, I think, just out of the, you know, George's perception of the absurdity of the trial and all of these dramas they were going through. But I don't know, it's just kind of nice to see the little Beatle brotherly love back in action here.
Yes.
So George had this to say about it in I, Me, Mine. He said, "Give me love. Sometimes you open your mouth and you don't know what you are going to say. And whatever comes out is the starting point. If that happens and you are lucky, it can usually be turned into a song. This song is a prayer and a personal statement between me, the Lord, and whoever likes it." So not actually a whole lot to say about the song itself there, but I don't know, kind of sums it up really.
Yeah, sure. Now there's this business in the Simon Lang about it resembling I Want You by Bob Dylan from Blonde on Blonde.
Yeah.
And, Yeah, there's some truth to that. But to make the point that these things aren't really, like, it's probably not really an homage or a lift. It's just a pattern that one encounters in popular music sometimes. And so I will play a bit of I Want You so people can hear what that's about. But I'm also going to play a little bit of Through the Eyes of Love from the movie Ice Castles by Marvin Hamlisch, sung by Melissa Manchester, and that's from 1978. And you'll hear that that's a slow version of the same chord progression and a very similar melodic pattern.
Oh my.
And you know, I'm always looking to get some soft rock pap on the show. So here it comes. Enjoy.
Drunken politician leaps upon the street where mothers weep, and the saviors who are fast asleep, they wait for you.
Please don't let this feeling end. It's everything I am, everything I wanna be. I can see what's
so I worked some Marvin Hamlisch in there, but look, we're never accusing anybody of lifting anything. And if it's a real homage, then we're always excited about that. But I don't think this is an homage to I Want You. I think it's just one of those patterns that pops up.
Yeah, I think I buy the homage stuff when the Beatles themselves say it, typically, and they will cop to it with some reliability. You know, I don't think John Lennon made any sort of charade of the idea that he was inspired by Chuck Berry for Come Together, for example. Like, he was very honest. The Beatles tended to be like, oh, no, like, this is me doing that kind of thing, as if to say there's nothing wrong with that, as opposed to somebody who's sort of trying to hide it. You know, and, right. And that's not a hard and fast rule for everything, and maybe it's just giving them the benefit of the doubt because I like them, but I don't know. I do feel like there is an air of honesty about that sort of thing. So, I don't know. He's friends with Dylan. They were all inspiring each other. I don't really see this as anything sort of controversial.
Sure. Right.
Yeah, the acoustic guitar sound is really nice on this. It's such a sunny, pleasant way to open the album, and it also, again, continues to point in the direction of George's production style and the kind of thing that we would be seeing from George albums moving forward in a way that I quite like. I think that one of my favorite aspects of this song is the acoustic guitar sound he's getting here, which I think is remarkably crisp and warm and feels like a nice, pleasant, sunny day and a wonderful way to open the album. And I think it really points the direction toward where George would want to take his production style and honestly just his albums in general after this. So once he sort of digs himself out of this depression hole he's climbed into, by the time we get to the mid-70s, mid to late 70s especially, the George sound really becomes this sort of extremely acoustic, earthy kind of thing. And this is one of those songs I think points in that direction pretty solidly.
Yes, agreed. Now, something I'll say about these next four albums we're going to talk about is that there's something going on with the production or the engineering that if you listen to them, definitely on the original vinyl, but even the remastered versions have this warm to a fault quality. It's a quality I associate with London Town and with Stevie Wonder's Fulfilling This First Finale, where the high end is rolled off so much that it sounds a little blanketed or something. It's just a general atmosphere on these next four albums. It's less of an issue on 33 and a third. So that's where the blanket seems to lift. But definitely the next three, they sound a little muted or stuffy, a little stuffy sounding. You know, people who remember our conversation about London Town will remember this. And I feel like it's a similar problem. Not a big deal. And he's erring on the side of warmth, which is good. And it's very mid-70s too, by the way. But it's a little murky or something.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I detect that a lot on Extra Texture, for example.
Yeah, that's the worst of the lot that way.
Yeah, when I think of London Town, I mean, we're not talking about London Town, but I think of like the kind of warmish sound you get on something like Children or something. But yeah, now that you mention it, I can hear what you're describing.
Compare London Town to Back to the Egg, which has that bright electric guitar kind of sound. London Town has this kind of, like everything's under, like their blankets over the speakers or something. Yeah.
Maybe Chris Thomas found the gain levels and he's like, wait a minute, we could have just upped this the whole time.
Yeah, or somebody turned up the suck knob, you know, that it happens.
right. No, and actually it's funny, London Town and this one to me are a little similar, where the first songs really are not indicative of the rest of the record in a bad way, in my opinion. Like, I would prefer more songs like this on this record, and I would have preferred more sort of cutesy kind of poppy, like changing tempo / changing direction songs like London Town on the album London Town.
Yeah, we have a few too many, we've already said it, of these kind of mid to slow tempo songs. We could have really used Miss O'Dell on this record, but we'll get back to it.
Hell yeah. Love Miss O'Dell. Yeah, but me too. Actually, you know, she's still around, Chris O'Dell. Well, yes, we're not talking about
that
right now.
We'll get to it, yeah.
I'm also immediately noticing on this particular listen the piano's role in the song and the album.
Yeah.
And I'd never really thought about how integral Nicky Hopkins was to this record until I did the research. But when you listen to it with those ears, you're like, oh, yeah, the piano's actually doing a lot of the work here.
Yeah.
Melodically, like the fills.
The piano kind of takes the melody for the B section, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So there's some really interesting work Nicky's doing. And I think Jim Keltner too, you know, the drumming sounds straightforward here, but it's actually got an unusual, almost vaguely Indian swing to it from time to time.
Hmm.
And
yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's just by virtue of, you know, people playing to George or George's songwriting or something, but I think both of those two people, Nicky Hopkins and Jim Keltner, on this song in particular, I was noticing, oh, wow, they're really adding a lot here.
One cool little thing in the lyrics here is I didn't know until I looked at the lyric sheet that he's saying, Om, my Lord. Oh. It's pretty cool to elide, oh, it comes off as, oh, my Lord, but he's saying, Om.
Interesting.
My Lord, yeah.
I don't know if I ever connected that. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I also really like the help me cope with this heavy load line. Mm-hmm. It's a line I think about often, but now I think about in different ways after having done the research and hearing like, oh, wow, he was carrying probably the biggest heavy load of his whole life just emotionally at this point.
Yeah.
And this is his plea. It's like, help me. It's literally, this song is his version of help. You know, it's just like, yeah. I am in trouble. Help me.
Yeah, it's the spiritualism cocaine dichotomy he's got going there.
Yes, you know. Yes. And the lawsuits, which bring us to track two. How'd you like that transition there? That was pretty good, huh?
That was well done.
Thank you.
And a fine song. And speaking of Nicky Hopkins, there's some sweet like tremolo piano on this that really gives it the right kind of mixture of square dance and blues.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Together we could have a bad time.
So we're talking about Sue Me, Sue You Blues, and I did not realize how pedestrian this song could be until I heard the version of it that George gave away to guitarist Jesse Ed Davis to record in 1971, released as a single in January 72. And when you hear the Jesse Ed Davis version, you're like, oh, this song could have been kind of awful. And again, no offense to Jesse Ed Davis, really. It's just, there's a way to do this song where you just do it as a straightforward, no frills, middle of the road blues number. And Jesse Ed Davis did that with George's demo. We should play a little bit of it here. And what I'd also like to do is play a little bit of the demo that he sent him. So when you hear George's demo here, it's going to sound almost like Robert Johnson or something. There's like this.
That demo is remarkable.
Yeah, it's like this Delta bluesy sort of thing. And it's just, I mean, it's by virtue of the instrument he was using, but it's a really striking demo. And I could see how somebody like Jesse Ed Davis would extrapolate his version from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so happy George took it in the direction that he did. So let's play a little bit of that here. Doesn't have any of that square dance quality or the interesting little drum pattern that Jim Keltner gives it. And Jim Keltner adds so much.
He really takes an important role on this particular record. And he seems to be playing the snare drum with the snares off. So it's just got that wide open boom kind of sound.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. It's an important part of this record.
Yeah. So the Jesse Ed Davis version, again, I don't mean to disparage the man. For those of you who don't remember, he was on the concert for Bangladesh. He played on the stage with George for that, and he was a friend of George's and things like that. So nothing inherently wrong with Jesse Ed Davis. He just did a very uninteresting version of this, and I'm so happy George revisited it. And it's not the first song that George either gave away or and then came back to.
It's strange, though, because it's such a personal song. It's so about the Beatles suing each other. It's hard to imagine what another person brings to that in terms of interpretation.
And that's ultimately, I think, why it feels so hollow, is because it has nothing of the personal charm. And when you hear this song, I don't remember if I put this in my notes or not, but it sounds like a rattlesnake is just slithering through the desert. And it's from that sort of frantic, kinetic, rapid-fire Jim Keltner drumming. It just leaves you feeling uneasy. And I can see how, or especially the imagery of a rattlesnake and some of these dangerous creature that is sort of slithering around, and until you may not even suspect it until it comes up and bites you in the ass or something. And I think George is really, utilizing the whole band here to capture that feeling of being hunted. And it's sort of absurd on the one hand, and then incredibly evil on the other.
Yeah, there's some real darkness in this song, yeah.
So I, like you and all of our listeners, are extremely steeped in Beatle lore. In George's I Me Mine, he says, "Sumi Suyu Blues is written in an open E tuning for bottleneck guitar as Woman Don't You Cry For Me. I wrote it during the big suing period, and it's vaguely based on the square dance type of fiddle lyric, where you serve me, I serve you." So
You're giving out dance instructions to the dancers.
Right. So if you were to read that, you may think, oh, this is kind of open to interpretation, or maybe he's like, I don't know, using it as a metaphor or something. No. Go through these lyrics and you will see a very detailed, accurate portrayal of the actual Beatles litigation.
Oh my God. These are amazing lyrics too. Court receiver laughs and thrills. But in the end, we just pay those lawyers' bills, you know?
So I want to read these here, actually. And I don't want to do this for every song, but I do want to read these because I think it's actually worth dwelling on for a moment. So you serve me and I'll serve you. That's that square dance thing. Swing your partners, all get screwed.
So that's a swingers pun.
Oh, funny.
Swingers, getting everybody gets screwed. Yeah.
Interesting. Oh, cool.
These are good lyrics. Yeah.
I know. Bring your lawyer and I'll bring mine. Get together and we could have a bad time. Okay. So it's really... It's really funny. And okay, maybe like that part is a little more like open to interpretation, metaphory, or whatever. It's affidavit swearing time. Sign it on the dotted line. Hold your Bible in your hand. Now all that's left is to find yourself a new band.
It's so specific. How could anyone else sing it, you know?
Right. So the band part, now you're like, oh, this is the Beatles. And then we're going to play Sumi Suyu Blues. Hold the block on money flow. Move it into joint escrow. So that's what happened to the Beatles money.
Yeah. And that's a good rhyme, by the way. Escrow.
A court receiver laughs and thrills. But in the end, we just pay those lawyers the bills. They were appointed a court receiver to sort out the Apple money. Like, this is specifically what happened with the Beatles. And that's what Paul wanted. Paul wanted out. Klein said no. The other three Beatles fell in line behind Klein. And Paul made the case, along with his excellent lawyer team, headed up by Lee Eastman, but not just Lee Eastman, it was others. And they were able to point to a pattern of basically fraud on the part of Alan Klein,
right,
and say, there's this person who is capable of X, Y, and Z. And they were able to prove in court that the Beatles had this four-way democratic partnership from the start. And Paul won. And the court said, okay, fine. So all those Apple funds were frozen immediately. So there's a really funny joke that for the first, you know, couple of years of Wings, literally no one was getting paid except for Linda, because Paul was also right. able to go to court and work out a settlement with the people who owned Northern Songs, which also involves Don Kirshner. It's really fucking weird.
Part of the whole story of Another Day being credited to Paul and Linda and all of this. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So they were able to work out a deal, actually, whereas John and Yoko didn't quite have that same legal counsel, shall we say. But Paul and Linda worked out the deal. So for a while there, Linda was the only one being paid in Wings, which is really, really crazy. But but anyway, it's because, yeah, the assets were all frozen and a court receiver was going through it going, what are we spending money on? Like, what is this? Like, they're going through, they're like, I guess this song is co-written by this person. Like, it's so funny to me that somebody in a court setting had to go through and deal with all the Beatles bullshit. Anyway.
Wow.
So that line is particularly really, really funny. And I guess there's no really additional lines in there other than the square dance part of it. But boy, what a great, great song. That, again, it's that Pisces fish thing on the dual nature of it, where it is at one point ridiculous and it is at one point the worst, most evil thing you could endure. It's just, and it's, I guess, a healthy way, like dealing with it with humor, you know?
No, it clearly inspired him. It's biting satire, clearly inspired him. And these are, I think, technically among his best lyrics.
Yeah. Inspired by just this awful pain.
Having a bad time.
Right. Yeah, that resonator guitar sound is just incredible. It could be grating, honestly. Like, under the wrong production hands, that guitar could have sounded really sort of tinny and screechy and awful. But the sound that he's able to capture, the engineers were able to capture on this, is really good.
Great.
And instead of coming across as annoying, it comes across as extremely effective. And also, it has that earthy quality I was talking about in Give Me Love, where it's like, it feels natural.
Well, and I think what I was trying to say earlier about the Nicky Hopkins piano playing is that it's like a honky-tonk piano.
Yeah.
Because with the trills and everything, it really feels like a honky-tonk vibe.
And yeah, that's not the first time the Beatles would invoke square dancing either for mockery or other purposes.
Well, yeah. Swing your partner, do-si-do, yeah. I'm familiar.
We're talking, for those of you who don't know, of course you know if you're listening to this program, but Teddy Boy, John Lennon famously mocked Teddy Boy in front of Paul McCartney as he sang it, as if to take the piss out of Paul and
Paul
say—
Paul took it pretty well.
Yeah, he took it well. He took it well. I also love Teddy Boy, so whatever.
Yeah, me too.
And then I just love this quote from the Simon Lang book. In 1973, George Harrison had more legal encounters than is generally thought to be wise. It's really funny.
Yeah. Hence the cocaine, right?
He wrote it about the Beatles, but he was also going through all this stuff with the Bangladesh funds too. So he is mostly in court for like 2 years.
Yeah, that'll put a person in a bit of a mood.
Yeah, kind of. We could talk about the instrumentation and everything on this forever. I mean, it's just an amazing song, but I don't have too much more to say about it. So if you're all good, we can move on to The Light That Has Lighted the World.
So I hear people saying this is about the Beatles, but I think that would be pretty self-serving if it were about the Beatles. The Beatles are the light that has lighted the world. Is that the interpretation? I think it's about God being the light that has lighted the world.
I think you're right, but I think that the interpretation of this is about George navigating his place in both the world and in his experience, which was the Beatles, is valid.
That's for sure. I think I'm just referring to what, you know, what the title actually refers to. I don't think is the Beatles. That would be pretty conceited.
No, I think that's the spark of creation, right? I think that's what that refers to, which is, like you say, it's like God or spirituality or something.
Yeah, and you can see in the first verse, he's talking, I think, about the fact that people are a little unsure about his religious convictions.
Yeah, so this is the second one that I pulled lyrics on. Again, I didn't do this for all of them, so people don't, I won't be doing slam poetry.
Relax, everybody.
living in the material world. But I do want to read these because I do think they're actually valid. And when I was listening to this on this current go-around, especially knowing the backstory, I was like, oh, yeah, this is the personal side. And I think I wrote this in my notes, is like, I think most of side A is a personal plea for help for himself. And side B is perhaps more a personal plea for the spiritual benefit of the world, if that makes any sense. So I think there's personal side, maybe a more personal side. I mean, the whole record's personal, but maybe A is a little more directed inward and B is directed more outward is maybe the better split there.
Sure.
But the lyrics here, I've heard that some people have said that I've changed, that I'm not who I was, how it really is a shame. The thoughts in their heads manifest on their brow. God, what a good line. Like bad scars from ill feelings, they themselves arouse. So he's talking about how people have been looking at him disapprovingly since this whole Indian thing started.
Yeah.
Wondering why he's not fab anymore.
Yeah.
And they furrow their brow and look disapprovingly at them. And I love that he equates those to scars crafted by ill feelings. Like, what a wonderful poetic statement.
Wonderful line, too, of the thoughts coming out of the inside of your head and showing up on the front of your head, you right. know, manifest on their brow. Some more good lyrics from George here.
So hateful of anyone that is happy or free, they live all their lives without looking to see the light that has lighted the world. So that, then, that's the indicator for me. Okay, I have been going down this Indian rabbit hole and the religion and all this stuff, and you've all been looking at me like I'm nuts, but all I'm doing is trying to get to the heart of life and cut away all of this material world. And that's what he's talking about here. That's the light that has lighted the world. That is the essence. That's what he's looking for. And what he's saying is they're ignoring it and focusing on the material world, focusing on the outside, how it even manifests in the world, where he's saying that doesn't matter. So it's funny how people just won't accept change, as if nature itself they'd prefer rearranged. And that is about the Beatles breakup, I think, or about him changing. So I think it's there's two things in there, but it's starting to swing a little Beatly, in my opinion there. So hard to move on when you're down in a hole. Well, that is exactly stating the mission statement of this album. He's down in a hole. It's hard to move on where there's so little chance to experience soul.
I always love when there's a rhyme like across sections of a song. So I love this, so hateful of anyone, I'm grateful to anyone. I really like that. And then kind of rearranging those last two lines. They live all their lives for giving me hope. You know, that's great.
Yeah. So I think it's about a couple things. I mean, there's more direct Beatley stuff on this record, but that's a pretty like direct response to the mystical one, air quotes, you know, like perception of George. I mean, even in Yellow Submarine, he's at the top of a mountain or whatever, like,
right.
Which is a caricature of what he morphed into in the mid 60s, but people had to see the caricature. And I don't know, it must feel weird, right? To see yourself pointed out in that way.
Well, there's this great line at the end of his I Me Mine quote on this. Would they rather everything were stuck in one place forever, about not accepting change? And we'll come back to this with Be Here Now. Everything is in flux. And that's part of the sort of Buddhist philosophy.
You said something in our Beatle George episodes that I've been thinking about a lot lately, which was you pointing out just how traumatized John and George particularly were by the Beatles experience. And I guess it's sort of ironic that those were the only two Beatles that were violently attacked by that experience, one of them fatally. But, you know, you can hear it in his voice on this song and in the lyric. And I think that of any song that directly pointed this out, there is evidence that this is George just unloading on that particular part of his life. I don't know. If he feels like he's in pain when I hear this.
How do you feel about this one musically?
It's one of a few dirges. As the dirges go, I don't mind this one as much because it's kind of, it doesn't overstay its welcome.
Mm-hmm.
It's like in and out kind of quickly.
Yeah.
And I think the guitar solo's great.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, really nice, really nice. There are ones I like more than it. I think, you know, and we'll get to Be Here Now, but I think as the dirges go, Be Here Now is probably the gold standard for me, but something like this is fine. It's a good track three to me. It kind of gives you a break after the first two. You open on this sunny thing, and then you've got this bit of a rocker, more up-tempo, and then we're in a lull for a bit before we pick it back up again. So I like it in its placement on the record, and I like that it's not too long.
Yeah, it works fine in this sequence position, I think, on the record. Harmonically, I think it's the least interesting of the dirges.
Yeah.
But the lyrics are so good, and again, it's so well placed. I really have no problem, you know, with it being down tempo.
Right.
It's funny how people just won't accept change, as if nature itself they prefer. So hard to move on when you're down in a hole where there's so little chance to experience soul. I'm grateful to anyone that
join us next time for part two of our discussion of George Harrison's Living in the Material World.